You're wrong. You're dreadfully wrong, in fact. Ryan got his colleagues to vote on budget resolutions twice that contained premium support as policy promises, and Nancy Pelosi told the world she was going to retake the House because of that. And she failed.
This is Dan Diamond, and you're listening to Pulse Check. 2,283. That's how many days it's been since President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law, more than 6 years. And in that time, Republicans have attacked it on the floor of Congress, they've assailed it on the campaign trail, but they haven't replaced it or even come up with a plan to do so. Until now, maybe. Paul Ryan on Wednesday released what House Republicans are calling a better way to fix healthcare, a white paper packed with conservative proposals. And I thought a good person to judge its merits would be Douglas Holtz Aiken. He was in charge of John McCain's economic policy in the 2008 campaign. He's now head of the American Action Forum, a conservative think tank. And Doug spoke freely with us, very freely, as you'll hear, about the Republican plan, about coming up with health policy for McCain, about the 2016 election, and even his comments on Donald Trump. You'll hear all of that in a moment. But just a reminder, Pulse Check is available on iTunes, on Stitcher, on other podcast apps. Every time you leave us a review or a rating, we get a small bump on the charts, and that helps new listeners find us. And I wanted to say thanks for the feedback so far. Our podcast with Karen DeSalvo, the HHS Assistant Secretary for Health, National Coordinator for Health IT, it continues to be widely shared on social media. And last week's episode, featuring Peter Bach and Ted Okun, breaking down the big fight over Medicare's Part B demo, it's probably our most controversial episode so far, and there's been a near 50-50 response from listeners who come down on either Peter's side or Ted's side. I'll be curious to hear the reaction to this episode, too. And with that, here's Douglas Holtz Aiken.
At CBO, when the Part D program went through,
right,
I had this weird parental devotion to the program, and if it gets threatened, I go ballistic. You can ask the staff. I'm not making this up. I just can't stand the thought of Part D getting messed up.
Is Part D growing up like a star student, or is it a little bit of a wayward child?
I'm very proud of it. I am. I think it's done wonderfully and has aged beautifully.
Mm-hmm. Full marks for Part D. Let's talk
That's
about
really
it.
That's really sick.
No. I mean, our policies might be better if lawmakers felt more attachment to them.
Maybe.
Let's talk about a different health plan, and that being the Republican health plan, which House Republicans have pushed out this week. Paul Ryan today, right before we sat down for this podcast, said, quote, "Here it is, a real plan in black and white." But it's not a bill. You know, 6 years after Obamacare passed, we don't have a Republican bill. We have this white paper. Is this a victory or a sign of defeat for the Republican health movement?
I think it's a victory in the following sense. Republicans have been accused for years of having no ideas. And I've always felt that criticism was really unfair. They actually had lots of ideas. And, you know, even in the recent past, we've seen, you know, Senators Coburn, Burr, and Hatch, and then, you know, Burr, Hatch, and Congressman Upton get together and put together plans. Tom Price. You know, I can name a lot of Republican serious health policy repeal and replace bills. But the public perception is that Republicans had nothing. And the reason was they had not agreed on a single thing and called it something. Democrats had a really hard time agreeing. They agreed finally, really, when Scott Brown won. Up until then, they were still not agreeing that this is what it's going to be. So for Republicans to do it in the absence of that sort of deadline, electoral threat, legislative, whatever, but to actually do the work and say, we agree on this, I think is a real victory.
And just to put some dates around that, I think Scott Brown won end of January into February of 2010.
Yeah, something like that. And, you know, at that point, there was a House and a Senate version. They weren't the same. They were going to continue to bicker and go to conference and you know, hash it out. But when they no longer had 60 votes in the Senate and it was no longer obvious they could do anything they wanted, they were done.
Necessity.
That was it.
Necessity forced consensus.
Yes, that was
it. In a way. So we're at a moment, Doug, where Republicans hold both chambers. And my colleague, Jen Habercorn, had a good story in Politico about this white paper where I think Phil Rowe said even Jesus couldn't get the Republicans to agree on anything. But the Republicans do seem agreed that Obamacare is a bad idea. So if they can't agree now, when will we get consensus among the Republicans on what to do next?
I think it'll be the same as the Democrats. They'll agree when they have to. If you're just being crassly political, doing the political math, why do a piece of legislation right now, knowing the president will veto it? In the process of putting together that legislation, you will inevitably make someone angry, pick a fight, and it's an election year. So why do it? They can do that math. They won't. Now, somewhere in the future, they may control the House and the Senate and have a Democrat as president. That's a configuration people could imagine. It could be there in the House. They have Democrats in the Senate. They're going to have this as their starting point. And then they're going to have to negotiate and see what they can get out of this. That's a realistic scenario. And they will agree when it comes time to vote on whatever that sort of compromise looks like, and not before.
And Republicans have made this point. The analog might be 8 years ago when Democrats controlled the Senate and Max Baucus came out with a white paper roughly around this time, I think, in June, with ideas that ended up informing the next year of the Affordable Care Act.
Yes, this is very much the Republican answer to the Baucus white paper.
Right.
And this is a detailed policy proposal. It's not a law. And it represents a good way to frame the debate.
It's not a bill when you ran the CBO, Congressional Budget Office. This is not something you would have been able to score.
No.
Just to make that clear to listeners. So I want to get a little deeper into what the Republicans proposed, a range of different provisions that we've either heard before or have been raised and perhaps pushed back down. What to you was the most interesting provision pushed forward in this new package?
I think there were really two. The first was simply the willingness to go forward again with entitlement reforms. Forget the specifics of the per capita allotments in Medicaid or the premium support and the transition to it in Medicare. Entitlement reform was a hot topic a few years ago and has disappeared from the congressional radar screen. The presidential presumed nominees, neither is talking about entitlement reform, but they chose to make the point, if you want to do healthcare reform in America, you have to reform the entitlement programs. They're driving a lot of the bad practice of medicine. So I applaud that. I think that's super important. I think the next most interesting thing was their willingness to go forward in an election year with talking about capping the exclusion.
And provision close to your heart and head.
And the source of my PTSD. The proposal we had in the 2008 campaign with McCain that they ran ad after ad against has scared a lot of Republicans for a long time.
And I just want to be clear here, because you're hiding your PTSD well in this conversation, but this was an idea that your team, you were chief economic advisor to John McCain in that 2008 campaign, of changing the tax treatment around health insurance. Barack Obama's team attacked viciously on that issue and then ended up incorporating it into the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah, so this is what I think is really so interesting. Conservative health policy thinkers have for a long time pointed to the non-taxation of employer-sponsored insurance as a deep policy flaw.
Right.
It had bad fairness features, right? It's a bigger subsidy to higher-income people. It's open-ended. Why would you have an open-ended subsidy that's more generous to the affluent than the poor? It's never made any sense to us. Second is, it really undercuts any sort of desire to be cost conscious in any way.
Right.
And
it's removing some of the downward pressure on the growth.
Yes. It's just go ahead, grow. And more recently, in the broader discussion of what's wrong with the labor market, why isn't anyone getting a raise? This is part of the reason that all of the cash compensation was getting sucked up into paying for health insurance. So it's really been at the root of a lot of what are perceived to be big policy problems.
And to be even more clear, because I know I've heard you speak on this, Doug, this goes back to the original sin. Maybe intended in a good way during World War II.
Yeah. This is accidental bad policy.
Yeah. As opposed to the deliberate policy right. we see all the time. But,
right. but at the time, you know, there were wage and price controls. You couldn't give someone a raise, so they gave them health insurance. And it became this untaxed fringe benefit. And it was how we ended up with the employer-sponsored insurance being the dominant form of delivery of health insurance in America. None of this, I believe, is how we would do it if we started from scratch again.
Right.
But we have this system.
And one of the challenges is because it's so baked in, it is hard to dramatically shift away from the ESI system.
Right. And so what's interesting about where we are now is twofold. I underappreciated, bluntly, the politics of this when we proposed on the McCain campaign.
In what way?
That just how potent the taxes health insurance for the first time, taxes your health care for the first time. That was a very powerful political line against a Republican. As the policy geek new to politics, I really didn't quite get that. The second was I didn't genuinely have as good a feel for America's fear of change. The notion of doing health insurance some other way than having your employer do it terrified people.
Right.
And so two things are now, and as you said, I think the other important contextual piece is Barack Obama politically attacked it, then turned around and his team understood the policy merits of doing something. And so they invented the Cadillac tax, a backdoor way to accomplish the same thing, in my view. But it's clunkier and has lots of undesirable features. So now you're no longer taxing health insurance for the first time. So the political heat has come down some. You're improving on the Cadillac tax.
One wonk told me this is the Mercedes tax that the Republicans are proposing versus the Cadillac tax that Obama's introduced. I don't know enough about cars to know if that's an apt analogy.
I don't either. I don't own a car.
I walk everywhere in D.C. So
such is life. But to me, it's fair. The 40% never made any sense to me again, because if you're in a 15% tax bracket, why are you suddenly being paid levied a tax of 40% on your health insurance? It
felt arbitrary.
You know, see, it does. And so let's do it in a way that makes sense, tax people appropriate to their circumstances. But the politics is you're fixing something instead of starting it for the first time. I think that's important. The second is they're very conscious to not erode the employer-sponsored insurance market. And there's been a lot of research in the interim about where do you cap it and not really push out a lot of ESI folks into the individual market. And that's what they're doing. So it's a much more nuanced approach. But I admire them in an election year, they're putting it in there. And they're saying, yeah, this is the right thing to do, and we think we can do it well.
I want to go back to the point that you made on entitlement reform, because there are a number of specific ideas that we've heard before. Maybe they weren't all put together in this collection. But run through a couple quickly. And curious for your reaction. Thumbs up, thumbs down. Raising the Medicare eligibility age to, I think, 67 from 65. Thumbs up, thumbs down.
In between, I'm wavering. And here's why. It makes sense that it should match Social Security. We should have an old age safety net that has some coherence. But there is the early retirement feature in Social Security. And the thing I am most worried about is the portability of insurance from work to retirement and what happens to people when they're 63. And they take an early retirement Social Security, they're not yet at the normal retirement age, and thus would be getting Medicare. Unless you have good, effective reforms elsewhere, and they have proposals for that, but it all has to work, or there's going to be this gap, and that gap's going to invite the age coming right back down.
Interestingly, Hillary Clinton has gone the other way on this, lowering the Medicare eligibility age, potentially.
Which has to be the biggest slam on the Affordable Care Act ever. Right, we do all of this to say that everybody in America is going to be covered. There's a mandate on employers. There's a mandate on individuals. We've got individual markets and exchanges. And she turns around and says, well, we got to lower Medicare eligibility age and let people buy in so they can be covered. That's really troubling.
So that precludes my next question. Whether you're thumbs up or thumbs down on that idea.
I'm thumbs down on that idea.
Back on the Republican beat, so Medicare eligibility age, big issue, but then Medicaid too, dramatic changes.
Yes.
And the idea of per capita caps, the block granting of Medicaid, changing how it is currently paid out to the states. Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Thumbs up. Medicaid doesn't get a fair amount of attention. I mean, you know, all the focus is on Medicare, Affordable Care Act. Medicaid's the biggest, has the most people in it. It is the most important.
Thanks to the Affordable Care Act, it is. Yes.
And it has the in some cases, some pretty good care, some managed care. There's some, for the dual eligibles, there have been some initiatives that have been very successful, but there's a lot of really bad care in Medicaid. And one Republican principle is you should allow flexibility in design to match the problems you have, and the problems differ by state. And so it gives the states the flexibility. That also lowers the stakes. Democrats tend to like these top-down approaches to say this is the right way to do it. If you make a mistake, then everybody's in trouble. This allows us to sort of do things a little bit differently. And the biggest thing that needs to be done in healthcare, the biggest thing, is to put healthcare on budgets. You know, in Medicare, there has to be a budget so that the providers, the beneficiaries know this is how much money there is, go do something good. You no longer get an open-ended draw on the Treasury. This is what this does for Medicaid. Here's the money. Go do something good.
Isn't it possible that there are models in the market already that would accomplish some of those things? For example, state innovation waivers to change how Medicaid is administered. So it really is 50 different laboratories right now.
So one way to think about this is one big dedicated funding for state innovation waivers. Every state's got one automatically. You don't have to come begging to us. Go do it.
The idea of capping cost growth, too, is something that Maryland and to some extent Massachusetts have looked into as well. So do we need the Republican idea to get us there, or is it possible to use what's already in the marketplace?
Well, the states have the option of sticking with what they got. They could ask for a block grant, and they've got state programs. And so, you know, what the Republicans are basically saying is not, here's the Republican approach to Medicaid, you have to do it. What they're saying is, you may do what you'd like. Here's the budget we're going to put it on, and you have the flexibility to go do what works. And if you think what you have works, go.
Another idea in the entitlement space, premium support for Medicare. Paul Ryan's idea that folks are going to be paying into the program, not a political winner, not something that's come up on the campaign trail this year. Or am I editorializing too much? Do you disagree?
I would disagree. I mean, I think...
You can tell me directly when I'm wrong, please.
You're wrong. You're dreadfully wrong, in fact. Horrifically wrong.
Elaborate on that.
So the important thing to recognize is, you know, as budget chairman, Ryan got his colleagues to vote on budget resolutions twice that contained premium support as policy promises in those circumstances. And Nancy Pelosi told the world she was going to retake the House because of that. And she failed. It's not a political loser. It's something that they learned how to defend. They learned how to explain. And it is the same thing that is the very popular Part D program at its heart. It is the same thing with better policy foundations as they're trying to do in the exchanges. It is a fixed subsidy adjusted for a person's income or age that allows them to control what they get in the way of insurance. And it's a way to put Medicare on a budget. I think the important thing to recognize is that's actually not a debate. Democrats put Medicare on a budget. They invented the Independent Payment Advisory Board. And what that says is if Medicare gets too big, you go cut it back. That's a top-down, you fix it. Republicans agree it should be on a budget, but it's a very bottoms-up thing. Here, we're going to give it to you, the beneficiary. Figure out what you want and allow the market forces to control it. So it's the basic difference in approach with the same observation. We can't just spend infinite amounts of money on healthcare.
Hey, this is Dan Diamond, and this is the part of Pulse Check where I normally log roll about some great Politico event or one of the other podcasts that we do. But today I want to flack for us, for Pulse Check. We're getting great reviews, but we're losing the informal horse race in the Politico office with the two other podcasts. They're getting many more reviews than us. They're picking up a bunch of new subscribers. So if you like Pulse Check, tell a friend. Tell people on iTunes by giving us a rating or even leaving a review. And most of all, tell me who you'd like to hear on upcoming episodes. I've gotten great suggestions. Doug was a suggestion from two listeners this week. And you can find me at ddiamond@politico.com. And with that, let's get back to Douglas Holtz-Aiken. This week, a new report came out. I'm blanking on where it came from. Maybe Urban Institute, showing that healthcare spending has been revised down from projections before the ACA. The White House has touted this as an example of costs are not growing as fast as they would if not for the ACA. What do you make of that assessment?
I admire their ability to spin things. I do. It's remarkable. There's no way scientifically to trace any sort of difference between a projection and the actuals to the specifics of the ACA. Those who've looked carefully at the pace at which healthcare spending has grown more rapidly than the economy all noticed that it started before the passage of the ACA.
Because of the recession. And
it had a lot of features. You know, employers were changing the design of their policies to sort of, you know, have the employees bear more of the costs and be more cost conscious. The recession had a big impact. There are places where you can't figure out what it was, like Medicare, where cost per beneficiary, even adjusting for the fact that they're healthier coming into Medicare, haven't grown nearly as rapidly. So there's an element of mystery here. And it's just clearly over-celebration to say, oh, the ACA did this. The things the ACA had, stepping back, I'm a noted critic of the ACA. The threshold criticism was, of the two problems, achieving high-quality care at lower cost and expanding coverage, it was very heavy on coverage expansions, writing a lot of checks to cover people. That's easy to do. It was very light on delivery system reform. And so I never thought it would do much. And the things that it did, like accountable care organizations, the Pioneer ACOs, a generous grader gives those a D. I mean, they're not working. Medicare Shared Savings Program, no. I mean, you can't find things in there that are ACA specific that quote did this. That's the issue.
I think the most generous grader might say it's incomplete and that we're still early enough in the adoption of these models. And I'll
acknowledge that. I mean, it is early. I don't think we'll adopt the models. I think the basic political economy of it's all wrong. And it's one of the reasons I was disappointed in the ACA. I just think it's better to say, let's do delivery system reform. If their savings plow them into coverage expansions, that's fiscally makes more sense. What they said was, let's cover all these people. And they said 30 million. There's a number. And then, now that you, every provider in America, has stretched the limit trying to do this, we're going to tell you how to run your business. And they were going to say, no. It was designed to lead to a provider revolt that didn't allow them to change the delivery systems. So I that was my concern at the time. And I still think there's some potential issues there.
Well, since you've told me before that I'm terribly wrong, I'm going to push back as firmly as I can, because I remember reading a modern healthcare survey just a few weeks ago, a survey of about 100 mm-hmm. hospital CEOs. Overwhelmingly, one, wanted the ACA to stick around, and two, wanted the delivery system reforms in the law to stay too. So my understanding is that the industry is actually pretty happy with how the ACA has phased in things like accountable care organizations, which to this point are voluntary. And if they're not working out, hospitals can say, forget it, we're out. But the pain has been relatively small because it's optional.
So I don't think we're disagreeing on that. See, so traditionally, the road to healthcare hell is paved with demos and pilots, right? Because if there's real pain, they complain and they never put them to scale. And so,
right, Congress can have these broad goals of accomplishing things, and industry pushes enough that
so that was
Medicare
my concern
backs
with the way it was set up. Now, the thing that I do believe is true, and this is literally assertion without an ability to prove it, you pass the ACA, every provider in America sort of looks it around and thinks, okay, they're watching us, and they all believe, I think, at some level, we're headed toward a world where There's going to be more capitation. I'm going to be more at financial risk, and they do react to that. I think that's been a clear change in the atmosphere around the health sector.
I see what you're saying. You're talking about like the Hawthorne effect.
Well, it is,
but at like a wide scale.
And so the thing that I would like is, let's make structural changes to the things that the federal government does, and like especially the entitlement programs, to lock that in. Because if they come to the conclusion that, you know, we're backsliding, that goes away, and you know, there's been a change. There's no doubt about it. I think I don't know how often you go to the doctor recreationally, but you know, if you go into
not enough, I'm way overdue. This darn Politico job keeps me from getting my checkup. But yeah.
Never before, if you go into a doctor's office, is there any discussion on how much something costs, or you know, we can do this, or maybe we can do that. That's not as expensive. That happens now. That's a sea change in sort of the culture of delivery of healthcare in the U.S., and that's a good thing.
maybe one or two more questions on the Republican plan before we totally move away from it. We talked about some of the things that are in it and things that you liked. What's not in this package that you would have liked to see? Or maybe it's so comprehensive, it has every idea.
It covers the waterfront. It does. I mean, you know, it's got the 21st century cure, so it's funding the medical science. The U.S. continues to have the finest medical science, doesn't have the best health care system, so preserving that's important. It has a strategy on coverage expansions and making sure that there is support for everybody. It's got the entitlement reforms I think are important. The entitlement reforms, I think Medicare reform in particular, is the most important delivery system reform we could make. And I think, you know, Medicare Advantage is the bridge to the future. In my view, there's no question. It is the end game of what even Democrats are trying to do now. Democrats want to have more and more bundling with some quality standard. Medicare Advantage is a big bundle.
And I should say, you and I know this, most people will, Medicare Advantage being the private payer version of Medicare.
It's a private insurance, but it covers everything. It's a managed care kind of setting.
And it's growing rapidly.
And it's different everywhere. And so if it's done wrong someplace and they go away, that's good. So you can actually have genuine market forces showing which plans are working. And there's a quality standard now. It's not ideal. Medicare Advantage Stars is the program. It needs to be improved. But I think those are the things that needed to be in there. The regulatory reforms, I'm a big fan of. There's this, you know, this insurance thing about, you know, what can be the ratio of the premiums to old people versus young people.
I think it's, 5-to-1 in this package?
And that's what the data say the costs are for people who are 65 versus, you know, 24. So,
and right now there is none of that in the Affordable Care Act. It's
3-to-1.
It's 3-to-1. It's not where it should be.
So this is sort of data-based.
Or it could be.
And I like the expansion of the HIPAA rule. So if you remain continuously covered, you can't be medically underwritten, have your premiums jacked up. So there isn't a big hole in this program, I don't think. They've covered, you know, delivery system reform, insurance expansions, support for those who need it, insurance regulation reform. Those are all things we needed.
Getting back to something you said at the beginning, Doug, that this is the goal here, white paper, teeing up for future legislation.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that squares with what folks have told me. Leadership Aid said that Speaker Ryan is, quote, confident that the plans would be signed into law with the Trump White House. But I know you. I've read what you've had to say, and I know that you've said that Trump's unpredictability could make us the, quote, North Korea of economics.
I did say that, yes.
So given that Trump is unorthodox, can we expect him to take this proposal seriously? Like, how seriously does this plan matter if we don't know what Donald Trump is actually going to do?
I think this plan matters even more, given what we know about presumed nominee Trump to date. He, for example, was criticized heavily by Secretary Clinton about his desire to, quote, repeal Dodd-Frank, the bad law. Dodd-Frank has lots of problems, and the financial regulation should be improved. If you have an alternative, if you put out, as Jeb Hensarling, the House Financial Services Chairman, has done, a specific set of proposals that replace it, you're not open to the, he just wants to roll it back and we're in 2007 again. That's what this does for Republicans on healthcare. They now have a very specific alternative. It's not just we're handing healthcare back to insurance companies. That was never the intent. This is important both in and of itself. It's part of a larger set of task forces. There's specific alternatives to the current one, and that's a very important piece of political armor for Republicans running for offices in the House and the Senate, independent of what the presidentials might do. Now, roll the clock forward. Perhaps Donald Trump is elected president. We only become the North Korea of economics if he defaults on the federal debt and we become a pariah. That was the source of that comment.
Right. You weren't talking about healthcare.
No, it wasn't. It was. But, I mean, there is a serious question. What would he want? And I think the answer would be he'd want success. He's a president. Presidents want success and to be reelected. If presented with something that was successful in getting people back in the House and the Senate, he would be very happy to sign this plan. That's my bet.
Okay. So just to confirm, you think that this white plan could be the future for a Trump healthcare reform?
Yeah, I do. I see no reason why, given the fact that it's been vetted, that it has solid policy foundations, that you're going to see people analyze it and put out scores of it, that he might not look at that and say, yes, I can support that.
I think what's tricky is he has been all over the map when it comes to healthcare. And I
don't know whether that, yeah, I agree with you. I mean, I don't know exactly how it'll play out, but I do know that he has displayed no deep policy instinct that is at odds with things in this plan. I mean, you know, it'd be one thing if you had Bernie Sanders. I don't think Bernie would sign on to this plan.
Well, I think one reason he hasn't displayed that instinct is because he hasn't been specific.
I know, but you know, I know no more than anyone else about sort of how this will all play out, but it just doesn't seem to me that the weight of evidence is that he would just somehow discard this.
Well, you have, I should be really clear with the listeners, you have unique insight because you were overseeing a presidential economic policy, which I seem to remember about this time 8 years ago, John McCain rolled out his healthcare plan, and it was pretty detailed, if memory serves.
It was very detailed. In fact, you know, one of the things I admire about this plan is the detail they put out at this point in the electoral cycle. When I put together John McCain's healthcare plan, he had gone from first to last. The campaign had gone broke. It was the fall of 2007, and his instructions were be bold. And
why did you join, just considering all of those base factors?
I started January 1, 2007 because he asked me to. Mm-hmm. I had worked with him at the Congressional Budget Office on an air tanker deal that Boeing was involved in that had some actual fraud in it. It also had this Enron-esque financial structure. We did an analysis of what a bad deal it was to the taxpayer. I enjoyed working with him, and he asked me. Now, the key fact is I had never been on a campaign in my life, not even a high school president. So I didn't know enough to say no.
God, what an awakening.
Yeah. So I thought naively I'll go run something that looks like the CBO inside this campaign, and I descended into the maelstrom that is the average presidential world. So live and learn. That's why I did it. And I told him I'd be in it till the finish, so I stuck it out through all that. And the key fact, though, from the point of view of this plan is I put it together at a time when there was no political pressure whatsoever. He was out of it. It was easy to say, here's the policy pure thing to do, John. And he said, fine, let's just do the right thing. When he, you know, personally revived the campaign, none of us did it. When he did it, put it on his back, got the nomination, and sort of the professionals flooded in, they took one look at the things we promised and just shook their head. I mean, they were like, what are you thinking? And I said, well, it's a good plan.
And was one of those things, the tax.
Yeah. They were terrified by that. And they weren't wrong. Barack Obama's team took one look at that and said, thank you. Huge opening.
Which gets to, well, first.
But my point, let's be very clear. That was my experience, and it taught me a lot about the politics of things. They know all of that. They know all of that and more, and the House Republicans still chose to put out this very detailed proposal. I think that speaks highly. I do.
Well, an observation and then a question. The observation being, as a policy wonk and who's found this campaign to be fairly light on policy.
Generous.
I dream of two campaigns, one run by you and one run, like the other by Peter Orszag, where it's just CBO proposals coming out.
I would just love that too.
I would geek out there. But the question I have is, does it pay in a presidential campaign to get specific about policy? Based on everything you just said, it sounds like it's opening up the flank.
It's a two-edged sword, right? So, you know, the thing among the sort of little things I learned in that episode was you as the policy person are the most hated person on the campaign, because you're sitting there saying things like, that's not true, or you can't say that, and the political guys hate it, right? So, you know, your job, which is to ground this in the data and the policy reality, is at odds with their desire for infinite flexibility. They want to be able to do anything. Now, the flip side to that is, if you run and you never say what you're going to do, you don't have a mandate to do anything. And so at some point, you know, the sort of the political tipping point becomes where you need policies and you need things you believe in and things you're willing to do. Every president's going to get a freebie in the first 100 days. They got to figure out what it is they care about and tell the American people again and again, and then they can do that. And so, you know, it's not literally true that you don't want to take a position in a presidential campaign, but it is always true that there's going to be a big internal fight about which one you're going to pick and how much you're going to say about it.
The frame around health policy has shifted so much since that campaign. I mean, right. We've talked a bit about the tax exclusion and how that's now become part of the ACA and insurance exchanges, which were backed by Heritage, among other groups, right. And now part of the ACA. Where are we on health policy from your perspective? Have things shifted dramatically one way or another?
I don't think so. It's been a little odd from my point of view. I mean, I didn't like the ACA. I was pretty clear about that.
You've made that point a few times, yes.
But I always said, this is not the end of healthcare reform. This is the beginning. Healthcare reform is going to be a continuous thing. There's lots about this that isn't right. We're going to try again. And the thing I was wrong about is how partisan it became and how everything got frozen in time. You couldn't touch the ACA. It's the president's signature accomplishment. He has to leave office with it intact. Medicaid, which is the primary source of the expansions, and Medicare, which was the primary paid for, got locked in with it, so you can't really do Medicare reform. And so we ran the clock for a long time with what I thought was this sort of continuous healthcare reform that would really, everyone agreed, needed to happen. We needed more affordable insurance options. We needed to reform the delivery system. We had to put patients at the center of thing and reward quality, and a lot of things we weren't doing. It's just taken a lot longer than I ever thought it would.
One critique has been that the plan, if starting with repealing the ACA and 20 million people have gotten covered through the ACA, that's going to disrupt at minimum how these folks are covered before something new can go into place, before they can get worked into some other program or system.
I acknowledge that. I mean, change is hard. And, you know, in your discussions with folks in the health sector, they say, look, you know, we want to keep the ACA. Well, part of that is like they've invested in the systems and stuff, and they're measuring things the way they want to be measured at the moment. And so I understand the concern about change. On the other hand, the ACA has built into it some disruptions that I think are actually quite bad. So if you cross the line from being Medicaid eligible to being ACA exchange eligible, you change insurance policies, you change your entire provider network. A lot of people do that every year. A great many people actually cross it twice, go up and back. And so now their care is being disrupted all the time. That's a permanent feature of the ACA. I don't like that. I like the idea that someone gets a policy and has their policy in their care network and they get to keep it. So there is going to be some disruption. That's true. But you want to build a system that's less prone to that kind of thing on a regular basis. And I think that's a good step for this.
The ACA has become, over the past number of years, so politicized. It feels to me at times like the new Roe v. Wade, litmus test on where folks stand on the political spectrum. First, I'm curious if you agree with that. And secondly, when do we get to a point, will we ever, when a Republican candidate can support the ACA and still win support from the party?
I don't see that happening. I think the lesson is you don't want to pass large reforms, whether they're healthcare reforms or tax reforms, immigration reforms, entitlement reforms. There's so many things that I believe are structurally in need of upgrade in the U.S. policy apparatus. You want to do all that, but you don't want to do it in a partisan fashion, because the minute you do, it becomes something with a bullseye on its back for strictly political reasons. It becomes independent of the quality of it, and it becomes impossible for a Republican to stand up and say, I support the ACA. It's this huge sweeping thing. They obviously support keeping kids on policies till they're 26. It's in here. You know, they support a well-designed tax on compensation delivered as health insurance. It's in here. It was in the ACA. So, you know, I think the politics are such that you'll never be able to support the ACA, nor should you. It's time to move forward past the ACA. This is where they want it to go. This is where, given their druthers, they would take it. The reality of the political system is this will only be durable if Democrats sign on to it, and it may not be the thing that is the compromise. We'll find out what the bipartisan deal is somewhere in the future.
I think I want to wrap up, Doug, with
sure.
a quick lightning round. Are you
okay.
game for
Ready.
Quick answers? Yeah, you're loosening up
I'm
again.
I'm warmed up.
Who's your favorite liberal healthcare economist?
Economist?
Mm-hmm. Or policy wonk, I guess, if we want to put the bucket a little bigger.
Oh, God, that's a tough question. There are a lot of them. They're real good.
You can give two or three.
My favorite person on is Howard Dean. Howard Dean and I have done any number of events together. We agree, I think, almost 100% on the diagnosis of the problems. We agree not at all on how to fix it. And I love being with Howard. I think he's a very smart guy. I love Zeke Emanuel, roughly the same thing. Plus, Zeke has the additional advantage of being just, you know, sort of personally crazy and interesting. I love that. And I lecture his class up at Wharton once a year. Sure. And so, you know, it's people like that who are willing to hear me out. I like hearing them out. I learn something every time from them, even if we don't agree in the end on exactly what we would do if we had a choice. But that's the nature of this business. You should start out figuring out what you believe, and then you got to figure out what you can get done. And that's a second step.
It's promising. You just mentioned two doctors. If you have the same diagnostic abilities as them, it comes to policy. Perhaps it extends in the operating room too. Is healthcare a right?
It's a legal right in the United States. Supreme Court settled that. I don't like the way Democrats typically toss around universal coverage or healthcare as a moral issue. And the reason for that is healthcare is a lot of different things. Healthcare is elective knee surgery for someone like me, a boomer who ran for 30 years. I had my hip replaced. I don't think that's a moral issue, right? There are moments when life is at stake that I think deserve that kind of consideration. But to throw it at everything that is in the American healthcare system, I think is an overreach. I think it's a disservice.
If you could change one thing about the American healthcare system that isn't the Affordable Care Act, what would you change?
Oh, it would be the vast amount of state-level regulation in terms of certificates of need and licensing procedures. And I mean, it's all making it harder to have good competitive health markets at the local level, which is in the end where healthcare is delivered. A couple of times I've thought that the next round of healthcare reform really is a state level issue. It's one of the reasons I like the Medicaid thing. It'll help to drive that. It does no good if we have monopoly hospitals all across America and, you know, barriers to entry so that, you know, you can't have someone deliver a low cost service cheaply. And we do a lot of that. You know, we underutilize a lot of the other kinds of providers.
If Donald Trump asked you to serve in his administration, would you do it?
At this point, I have to say no. I mean, if you work for the White House, you defend the president's agenda. And that is your job. And so you better believe in that agenda. And he has said and promised things that I simply do not believe are good for America and I won't defend.
So have you talked to his campaign at all about their policies? Or
No.
Yeah, I mean, he's been infamously somewhat of a black box.
But. Yeah. I mean, you know, I get asked every day, whether it be health or trade or, you know, tax, you know, who's he talking to? Who are his advisors? And the answer is, I don't know.
That's it for Pulse Check this week. Thanks to our guest, Douglas Holtz-Aiken. And thank you to our producer, Bridget Mulcahy, and editorial assistant, Mary Lee. You can find Pulse Check on all of the usual apps. I know I say this every episode, so you should know where to go. But in case you don't, Stitcher, iTunes, other podcast apps too. And we'll be back again next week.